Welcome home. We are WNST, AM 1570, Tass in Baltimore. We are Baltimore Positive. I got the Maryland Crab Cake Tour out on the road. We're going to have some lottery scratch-offs to give away on Friday. We're going to be at Pizza John's in Essex. I know some of you on the west side, the north side, haven't been over to the east side, so we got to get you over to Pizza John's. Dave Shinen, one of my favorite sports writers of all time, will be joining us on Friday. Luke Jones and he are going to do some baseball things. I think Todd Schuller's going to come by and talk about the law and democracy and just little things like that. Our former delegate and councilman. And we're going to be doing that on Friday. And then we're off to Toronto next week for opening day. Luke and I are going north of the border. Rick Emmett from Triumph told me to wear the Canada hat, bring the passport, do everything nice, get in, get out. Maybe they'll let me back in. I'm not sure. We lost a friend this week, and I've tried to reach and to as many people as I can who knew John Feinstein in some way. I've reached to some Washington friends of mine. So I guess over the next couple of weeks, we turned the entire radio station over to John on Friday when he passed on St. Patrick's Day weekend. And when I went to look, I was astonished at how much time John had given me over the last 20 years of my life, where literally every time I ever text him, he texts me back. He came on, he gave me a half an hour, 54 minutes into a conversation. We would have done a half an hour piece. And I had 22 hours of John Feinstein tape. And on Thursday night, before I went to bed, I said, I got to run that because all of it was sort of evergreen. They were stories that didn't have anything to do with this weekend's brackets or this weekend's Redskin game or Capitals game or any of that kind of stuff. It was storytelling. And along my timeline, and I guess this is how the algorithm works with Zuck and with the South African Fuhrer, is that things pop up on my timeline. And so many people love John Feinstein. I'm pissed at John, and I know you're out there listening, John. You didn't sign the book when he sent it to me, but I have all of these books that John wrote, including I'm going to reach to Mark Messina this week about his brother and the Messina Glavine book and all of the. I can't reach to Bobby Knight, but I do know some people. Mike Vaccaro identified himself, and there were a lot of people saying, Feinstein, it was this and that. And I'm like, dude, give it a break. He's dead. I mean, give him a day or two to be not, you know, like I like John was always irascible. He was curmudgeonly in the greatest sense of the way. And I think most of the old ones that wanted to be Oscar Madison were. Mike Vaccaro joins us from the New York Post. He identified himself as a friend of John Feinstein. So I'm beginning with the friends. We'll get to the foes later, and John would appreciate it that way. You know, as I wrote, and when Vinnie Perrone wrote about my friend Clem Florio at the Washington Post, we lost a force of nature. You know what I mean? Like he was just a really transcendent fellow, John Feinstein.
When Feinstein was in the room, you knew Feinstein was in the room. And you talked about having 22 hours of him from past radio conversations. That's what it felt like to have dinner with John, because he had an opinion about everything. He knew everyone, and he loved telling stories. And it wasn't just that makes you friends with somebody, but certainly it's a nice way to start. He was just excellent company. I enjoyed every bit of my time there. I never worked with John, so I get it. I get it. He can be a complicated guy. I understand that. I'm sure I'm considered that by some of the people that I work with. But you know what?
You read my mail, obviously.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, in term, but just in terms of just having a conversation with somebody, there was nobody better, because he was engaged. He was never one of these guys ever. And this is back when. And we first met when I was working at a No Place newspaper, and he was still already John Feinstein. And he was never a guy who would talk to you in a crowded room with his head on a swivel, waiting to see who the next person to talk to, somebody better, more important, higher up the food chain than you. When he was talking to you, he was talking to you. And that was true when I first met him. That was when it was really just hero worship on my part. And it was true over the next 30 or so years when we became genuine friends. We'd have dinner every year at the Final Four, where, there's it's kind of like having dinner with Prince Charles at or King Charles at Buckingham Palace, right? Because that's where all of his subjects were, and it was a remarkable life, and I feel really blessed to have been a part of it and had him in part of my life, and I miss him so much, especially with March Madness. But this was his time of year. and he would revel in it. And so it's difficult to imagine this going on without him here.
I don't think there was a March he didn't do my show. I mean, I went back and I looked because it's very easy to archive it on YouTube over the last dozen years since I've been doing video, and I know I have tapes, literal and mini discs from that era before. And you said hero worship. Dude, I talked to about you to my wife last night because you both have had health challenges in different ways. And I said to my wife, I'm trying to reach to some people to come on to sort of talk about John because I'm not just going to let this pass. I'm not going to let him pass March week. And the people that didn't like him to say that, the people that did like him and respected him professionally and all that. But there is something about guys like you and me who all we wanted to do was be Oscar Madison. That's all I ever wanted to be was a sports writer. It's all. They're putting Tom Davis into the Hall of Fame here, the Orioles Hall of Fame. All I wanted to be was Tom Davis, who's a local broadcaster here, or Vince Bagley, or Chris Thomas, who really was my inspiration, and really John Steadman and those people. And I honestly, Mike, I literally until I, first off, the St. Bonaventure thing, I'm going to get to that in a minute. But we're the same age. I mean, I didn't realize you. I thought you were older than me because I think of you as this sort of venerable columnist guy. But you kind of came in on the young end, kind of like me and Rosenthal now. So I was Rosenthal's understudy, 87, 88, 89, 90, 91 at the paper when I was like the agate clerk. But I was covering hockey and in press rooms at the Capitol Center at Bullets games and covered Dr. J and different things. I did a lot of different things, but I was the always young. So everybody that's even my age, I think, are older than me. But then I looked at them like, 1990, graduate college, I graduate 85. Like I'm thinking like we're the same age. I met Feinstein when I was 17 years old at a Bullets game. I went to a Bullets Nets game with Phil Jackman, and Jackman was just trying to teach me how to be a reporter, and he had the reporter. He was from Worcester, and he would say, "You do the visitors. Hey, I'll do the home this week. You do the visitors." Or he'd have a friend in the other locker room say, "You do the Bullets tonight. They stunk." So he would make me do locker. This is Phil Jasner. This is Stephen A. Smith early on. This is Feinstein, Christine Brennan, Tom Boswell, Len Shapiro. Like at the Capitol Center, I'm a kid. And I go into that press room, and there's Abe Pollin over there, and Wes Unseld was an executive then, and Jim Lynham's probably coaching the team, or maybe even before that with like Shue and Bob Ferry, these legendary people. And Feinstein was just holding court, mainly about the Redskins in that era, right? Because it's mid-80s and like all of that. He was larger than life when I was 17 years old. And then I found myself years later in this thing where he's doing this book on Billick and the team. And I was that guy that I literally said to my wife, all of the negative things you would say about John, and you're the first piece I'm doing, so I'm getting to bare my soul a little bit with you. But like I would say to my wife, that arrogant prick Feinstein is in on my turf. He's in on the Ravens, and I'm getting boxed out. Little did I know Chad Steele would throw me out 2 decades later, for living the dream of wanting to be Oscar Madison and John Steadman. But Feinstein, from the minute he knew he was in my turf, and he's like, "What are you doing here?" And I'm like, "What are you doing here?" And at some point, Billick said, No, he's always here." Like, and then after that, Feinstein's like, "Oh, I sort of get it. Brian likes you. And Brian likes you give him after the games. And he gives it back." And then Feinstein got in on it. And all of a sudden, I said to my wife by like week six, I'm like, "This is like getting popcorn. I don't even talk. I just let them go at it. And I'm now the guy chronicling what crazy stuff Feinstein's saying to Billick after games that I used to say." And now it's a 2-on-1. And the team took a dive at the end of the year. And I was in on hard, I was in on the in of the in where he's writing this book. And then after that, our relationship changed. Like from that moment forward, it became like, I want to come on your show and tell stories because you tell, because, and then after that, the last 22 years of his life, Feinstein and I knew him as a hero worship, like, but we hero worshiped all of those guys. I
Sure
mean,
did.
the Howard Cosell, the one time in my life I saw him in the parking lot at the Preakness, you know what I mean? That's, Feinstein was one of those guys, and he wasn't so far our senior that he felt attainable to young sports writers and mostly available because he was always available to me.
His nickname was Junior, which I always found funny because, I mean, he was, 9 or 10 years older than I was, 10 years older, I guess. And it always seemed funny to call a guy that much older than me junior, but I understood it because he really always did relate more with the younger writers. I mean, he was in no way was intimidated or scared of the older writers. And when he walked into the Washington Post, it was an established cast of all stars. Kornheiser was there, and Wilbon had started around the same time, and he held his own with all of them, and all the old timers too, and reveled in that, and
That was a hell of a section, man.
reveled in being the kid on the staff that was able to kind of fight for his place. And I had a very similar introduction to him as you did, almost an identical one. I mean, he was working on his Army Navy book, A Civil War, in the fall of 95, and he would spend half his time at West Point and half his time in Annapolis. And our paths crossed a lot because in those days I was working for a paper in Middletown, New York. We were the paper that covered Army, and myself and our beat writer Kevin Gleason. I didn't even have the period of wait and see that you had. I mean, he was immediately, he immediately took us in as if he would, Bob Ryan and Dan Shaughnessy, if he ran to them covering a Red Sox game. It didn't matter what our status was. It never occurred to him to worry about what our status was. He knew that we, he, I mean, he saw that we, that our bylines were in the paper almost every day about West Point, that we knew what we were talking about. And obviously at first he looked at us as resources, which we were, because he was coming in cold. We'd both been covering the team for a couple of years. And I mentioned this in my column the other day. Being around him when he was doing that book, it was like taking a graduate course level in not just journalism, but specifically in reporting. And just seeing how he always had second and third question immediately ready for his first question. How he would manage to gain the trust of kids who by then were 15, 20 years younger than him, and they stayed lifelong friends forever. I mean, Jim Cantaloupe is a guy that I'm still friends with. He was a player on those Army teams, a fierce, just a quintessential tough Army football player, defensive player. And he and John became tight, even though, I mean, they couldn't have been more, diametrically opposed politically or philosophically on a lot of things. But John had the gift of being able to allow you to open up and tell stories. And there's nothing, no greater gift if you're a storyteller. And 44 books later, you understand that there was a reason why he was able to produce such remarkable work. I mean, he would be the first person to tell you, I'm never going to be remembered because of the way I put words together. I'm a fine writer, but I'm not, he said, I'm not Tom Boswell. And it didn't matter because the stories were so thoroughly researched and so intensely reported that he allowed the story to tell the story for him. And there's something to be said for that. That's a great discipline, and there was none better at it, because why wouldn't you rely on that? He's probably the best storyteller, and one of the best storytellers, especially in sports, that ever lived. So why not rely on that gift?
Mike Vaccaro is our guest. He is a columnist for the New York Post. You can find him anywhere. Vaccaro is a great name in Baltimore because they make the best
No, it
desserts.
is. I have been there.
I know you probably have.
I've made my pilgrimage, yes.
They did the desserts at my wedding as well. So, get the wedding cookies. They're delicious. For John, he wrote a book on the Ravens, right? So my story with him is seeing him in the 80s, reading him in the 90s. I'm an old newspaper head, so as I said, a great section. I was a part of the Evening Sun, the Morning Sun, the News American. How even 30 years later, those relationships, even the other night when I wrote about John and I was sniffly and teary at dinner with my wife, and I at 8:20 at night, I had a glass of wine and I'm talking to my wife, and I'm like, I got to go write. That's what writers do. So I went upstairs and I started to write about John a little bit and thinking about, all of those, that time in the 90s when the Redskins were on and the Orioles were on, and they were always up here because of Cal Ripken. And but you mentioned Boswell. I mean, all of the great, everything that came from George Solomon and the Washington Post and the competition with the Sun and some Baltimore people that went and worked in Washington. Tom Lavero is going to come on later this week as one of those guys, but that's a Sun and went to the Times. So back and forth. And I didn't know you had Kansas City in your background. You had all this other stuff, and I knew about the West Point part, but there is a point where all of us run into each other if we've done it. And I've done this since I was 15 years old. Hockey, basketball, football, I'm at college basketball, Final Fours. I've done all of it. And when you run into people, there's a big leaguing part and there's a hey, I'm working part. And but back in the day when there were real newspapers, as John Eisenberg would say, the glory days of newspaper and journalism and me wanting to be a columnist and you wanting to be a columnist, that the I did hero worship every person that came to town on every beat in every press box. I was working it. No matter who it was, I wanted to know everybody, everything. I wanted to work at ESPN. I wanted to, like, all of that. Feinstein was one of these guys that just sort of trucked along writing these books and columns, books and columns. I mean, he wrote 41 books. He only lived 70. I mean, it's a book a year every year of adulthood, literally, right? And they're tombs. He didn't sign this one. I wanted to point that out for, I don't have a signed one, but I've read five or six. I'm not a golf guy, so I wouldn't have been a guy to read the golf books. The Bobby Nutt, I mean, Caesar on the Brink, everybody read that. But he wrote a Raven book. And there's only been three books ever written on the Ravens in 26 years that I know at. I wrote two of them. And I wrote the first one like as a diary in 2001. We were so happy to have the team here and Ray Lewis and all of that stuff. By the time the second one came, John had written a great book on the Ravens, even though it wasn't a great season for the Ravens, but it had all of this Billick Bisciotti drama that wound up playing out to making Brian Billick my business partner when he got fired. But it was all in the book because he researched it all. And I read the book in 2005. And then I put the book down and life went on. And I saw John. John did UMBC games and back. And we just saw each other here, there, five Maryland games, wherever. And I would always say to him, man, you're a hell of a writer. I would always say that to him when he would come on the show and whatnot. But then the Ravens win a Super Bowl. And I thought, do I want to write a book? No, because you've written book. It's not the smartest thing in the world to write a book. And I say that in all honor of Feinstein, who made a little money doing it. Most of the rest of us have had to scuffle with the books in the trunk of the car for the next 10 years. But I was going to write a book. And everybody was hitting me, you got to write a book. I'm like, okay, I'll write a book. I own the station. We had done well on the trip. I had 3 months of my life to say, I'm going to write this book. And the first thing I did, I mean, I swear to you, when I landed back from the Super Bowl in New Orleans after the parade, was picked up his book and read it as fast and as hard as I could with a yellow marker. I think he signed that one for me, so I got to go find that one in the box. But I marked it up, and as I wrote my book, I decided to write it third person. Completely from the outside as a writer, which is not my style as a columnist or whatever. But I wrote a third person book that was 550 pages. And all I did for the next 4 months was try to channel him. And I told my wife, I put his book on the toilet. And when I visited, I would read it to get inspired. I would just read three or four pages of the prose and the way that the sentences become paragraphs. And I just would try to, when I was trying to profile Joe Flacco, all I could do was look at him profiling Kyle Bowler and saying, how do I emulate that just a little bit? And
Right.
dude, I'm a writer and you're a writer. That is, I mean, there is no higher praise that I could pay to anyone to say when it came time for me to do a book, I swear I tried to do it. I couldn't do it like he could, but I tried to play the chords, man.
Well, smart. I mean, if you want to be a great songwriter, you're probably gonna spend a little time seeing how Paul McCartney came about making "Hey Jude" or "Let It Be." And if you want to be an actor, you probably want to study De Niro a little bit. So, if you want to write a sports book, there's literally nobody who is better at the craft than John Feinstein. So, that's smart scouting on your part, Nestor, because you want to learn from the best, and
I failed miserably, just so you know.
But he provided, he, you know, he provided, what is it, number 41, 44, however many books he wrote. That's when you know you're prolific, when you can't necessarily put your finger on how many books a guy wrote. But he left a trail for us how to do it. And that's an incredible legacy to leave, among many other legacies that he's leaving, is just his work, which will stand in his stead forever.
He's told me a bunch of stories, and I have 22 hours of it. Give me a story or two that are your favorites. I know you wrote about one last week, Bobby Knight, but what do you know about? Because Feinstein would say anything to me on the air. I mean, oh my God! Like when he would come and do the show, it is, it's a gift to me that if I want to know what he thought about anything, Dan Snyder, Peter Ann, I have it all because I've asked him about all of it. Bob, the Woodward stories, when Trump was president, he would come on and just, he did an hour of Woodward stuff with me once. I mean, I mean, I have this on this, but you had dinner with him. I don't think I had a couple press room, biscuits with him, but I never went out Final Four weekend with John. I didn't know him like that.
Like I said, that's one of the, great fortunes of my career is being able to develop a relationship with him like that. He got inducted into the Sports Writers Hall of Fame. They have every year in Winston-Salem, and I was there 1 year inducting my friend Joe Posnanski, or introducing my friend Joe Posnanski, who was Sports Writer of the Year. And in the lobby of the hotel when he checked in, it was like what happens when the Yankees go on the road, or when would you imagine before security. Huge security became a part of the thing. What it was like when, any other sports team or any other rock band, frankly, went on the road, and that that weekend is set up to kind of make sports writers feel awfully important. But John, after basically, checking in and then getting to the elevator after like signing 50 autographs and shaking 50 hands, said, "I love this place. It's the only place where they treat sports writers like the Beatles in '64," and, that was John, I mean, he understood the importance of John, but he understood how important it also was to be accessible to his colleagues and to his friends. And, he wrote a number of blurbs for books during book proposals. And obviously that's, any sports author who's trying to sell a book, tried to get John to give the papal blessing. And, that certainly didn't hurt. But yeah, I mean, I know the story I told in my column. I mean, it's worth repeating. I mean, twofold. One, he told a story that night about earlier in the Final Four, him and Gary Williams, and they were very close. John had covered Gary at American and remained close with him for years. And by now, Gary was at Maryland, and Knight was still at Texas Tech, I believe. And they were walking into a hotel. Knight was walking out. Knight and Feinstein hadn't talked in 26 years, since the season on a Brink ended that relationship pretty famously and furiously. And suddenly here comes Knight and he walks over and he shakes Gary's hand, says, "Hi, Gary," shakes John's hand, says, "Hi, John," and they both say hi back, and then John and then Knight walks away. And they take a few steps and Gary says, "How can you talk to that son of a bitch after all the stuff he's put you through the last 25 years?" And John turned to Gary and said, "Gary, the man built my house." Which, I mean, pretty much sums up John's attitude toward everybody. Nobody was over important to him, but he was right. That book, not only in the moment made him a fortune, but allowed him to have this career that even all those years later he was grateful to have. But later on, he and I were having dinner at a Morton's with Steve Politi from the Star-Ledger in Newark. And about half an hour in, a bottle of wine appears, and it's a pretty expensive bottle of wine. I mean, I can't tell that, but John certainly knew. And he looks up, and across the room, waving, was Roy Williams. And as we all know, John was a was probably one of the most famous Duke alums living. And Williams came over, and they shook hands and laughed. And he said, "Do I have to drink this? This is Chapel Hill wine." And we didn't know that the Hall of Fame was having dinner in an adjoining room. And so pretty much every living member of the Hall of Fame was in that room. And pretty much everyone in that room wound up wandering by our table to say hello to John. And as Politi said, it was like having dinner with the MC of the event. And they kept arriving like an order of importance, Reggie Miller and David Robinson and Dean Smith and on and on. And Krzyzewski was there, of course. He finally came over, and it was just it was surreal, And every one of them wanted to buy John a bottle of wine. I mean, if he had, we never would have made it to the championship game the next day. But that's just living in John's world. It was a fascinating world. It was a fascinating world to visit when he allowed you in. And I, like I said, I'm grateful that that I was one of the many that he allowed in to share what that world was like, because it was spectacular.
Yeah, I mean, every radio host in America would like to have him on the show or throw him a note, and maybe he'd be kind and come on once in a while. I'm like that with guys like you, where I don't hit you every, once a year here and again, and it's what I do. I always say yes when people ask me, because like
Sure.
it's all I've been doing for 34 years is asking other people. But John was always, and when I hit him, he didn't hit me back last week, but I know he would have. And there is a there's a palpable loss for me, and just along the wisdom I missed along the way, and for people like you. So it is a pleasure to have you join us. Mike Vaccaro is here from the New York Post. Well, we've done a lot of John, but John would be upset if we didn't talk a little March Madness. So I didn't know you, St. Bonaventure. Like, I looked up the St. Bonaventure part of trying to research you a little bit to say, now I know there was a West Point thing, and I know there was another newspaper and all that, and I think of college. I think of you with college basketball, and I think of you with the Yankees, certainly. And I think of you as New York sports in a general sense. I think we've talked about all of that, including the Knicks and hockey, even a little bit. But
Sure.
the Bonnies thing, like, I always think that to be the strangest thing in the 80s to go to school there because of the Big East thing. And it always felt like they must be a big school. And then I look it up, and it's just this little
Yeah.
place in the middle of, like, you can't even define where it is. Nobody could ever find St. Bonaventure.
Yeah, well, it's in St. Bonaventure, New York, which means it's in the middle of nowhere. It's bookended by Olean and Allegheny, which kind of furthers that definition. I found myself there. It's got a very, very strong mass communication department, has for years. That's what drew me there, literally, because I was they gave me a small scholarship coming out of high school, because I had been part of my student newspaper in high school, and that's how I got there. And everybody who gets there kind of has a funny story about how they got there. We always joked about how it was everybody's safety school.
Couldn't get into Syracuse. Is that what it
Once you
was?
didn't get into Villanova, Syracuse, you dialed up Bonaventure, which is unfair but funny. And it's and during the time I was there, it was really a heady time. I mean, newspapers were huge, and they really did seem to be opportunities everywhere if you're willing to work for them. And I was fortunate to have a kid show up 2 years after I majored in Wojnarowski, and the two of us were of a like mind. I mean, we were the guys who would call the Roanoke paper to see if they wanted a story because Virginia Tech was playing in town. Not necessarily the Bonnies, if they were playing, the Canisius at the Buffalo Wad. It cost us more in gas mileage to get to Buffalo than what we would get to string those games, but we wanted the clips, and we were of a like mind. I was in the room for the first Woj bomb, because the basketball coach had been fired. He and I got the news. We had it alone, but it was Wednesday, and the paper didn't come out till Friday. So some sad news is going to break, just by release the next day. And so it was Woj's idea to call the Buffalo TV stations, the ABC, NBC, and CBS affiliates, and offer them the story in return for credit. I mean, it never would have occurred to me to do that. I mean, it occurred to Woj to do that, of course. And we
What's the
did.
name of the paper at the St.
It
Bonaventure?
was a very, very imaginative name, The Bonaventure.
The
Meaning it.
Bonaventure. So, sources at the Bonaventure say that
Well,
Bonnie's head coach, who was the coach? 1988, 89, we're in there.
Ron DeCarli was the coach that was fired.
Okay.
And yeah, I mean,
I can
whether.
name all the other coaches, Massimino. I go through the whole conference,
Yeah.
it's John Thompson, but St. Bonaventure, I was an agate clerk in 84, 85, 86, 87. So it always popped up. And then Georgetown and Villanova became a thing, obviously, 84, 85, in that range. But St. Bonaventure was like, they're in it. They must be like big, like Providence or something. I don't know. Because when you're a kid,
Well,
you think of.
they're actually in the Atlantic 10, so that's part of it. They didn't make the cut for the last Big East school. They chose to ignore Buffalo as a market for some reason, and that cost
But
that
they were
cost
always playing
them.
George Washington,
Yeah, right,
Temple, right? All of
right. They
those,
were
right?
playing. They were in the Atlantic 10, which, look, in those days, they were 3 and 4 mid league, because they had Temple, and they had Rhodey, who was very good, and they had St. Joe's, very good. West Virginia was in the league, very good. Rutgers had some pretty good teams, so it was a pretty rugged league. It wasn't East, but it was still, right there with them. And
But it's a
they had
small
some.
little school that was playing
It's
big, right?
15.
Like Duke did that
Yeah,
too, right?
it's 2,000 students. It's still the smallest school to ever make it to the Final Four, which they did in 1970, long before my time with Bob Lanier.
Dude, 2,000 students. My high school had 16,
Yeah, crazy.
1,700.
Yeah,
Yeah.
mine had 1,700. My high
Yeah.
school. So it made for a kind of a unique college experience, I guess. I enjoyed it. It was a, and you really do get it. I don't know how many other Bonaventure people are in your life, but they tend to be fiercely loyal to the brand and fiercely loyal to the Brown, as we say. And yeah, so I mean, but just as a, but because it was so small, I mean, if you would have gone to Syracuse, you might have had to wait till you were a junior to get a job on the student paper, or you would have maybe never gotten a chance to go on the campus radio station. And for me, I was able to do them the first week I was there. You were able to do everything that you were ambitious enough to try to do. And a guy like me, I needed that. I mean, I guess I had a little bit of an ability just born with it, but it's got to get developed somehow. And it's like I tell young writers all the time, being a writer is like, trying to build your body in the gym. How do you build up your biceps? How do you build up your triceps? Reps, a million reps, and you do it and you get stronger. And it's the same thing with writing, and that's what I was doing, trying to hustle after all these, stringing stories, assignments, just to try and get better, to try and figure out, how to tell a story and how to tell it right, how to tell it properly, how to be a good reporter. And that's, St. Bonaventure was small enough to where I had every opportunity to do that. And that's why I'm forever grateful for what it was. And, the fact that me and Woj both went up there at the same time is a hilarious bit of coincidence, but also serendipity. And, we helped each other out at very early and nascent parts of our career. Now Woj is back there as the general manager of the basketball team, which is one of the great sports stories of the
Yeah,
year.
I wanted to ask you about that because I knew you knew him and I knew that there was a pathway. I didn't know it goes back to like me and Kevin Eck to childhood or whatever, or at least what childhood was. His pathway to saying, and I know Adam Schefter really well, okay? And I don't know Woj well, although I mean, although back in the USA Today era, but I don't know him at all, like literally. But like there are people in the industry. Ken Rosenthal being one, Adam Schefter, some of the news reporters I know extremely, extremely well. And that beat of being on the clock all day, every day for breaking news and the agents and how the agents control the information for that. And then there's also the point where, like, you brought up like me, that it meant something to get credit. It meant something to break a story. There was an ethical code across all lines that you credited. The source for the story. Kind of all that's gone away in the last 15 years. I used to take all that really seriously until I turned about 45. And then I'm just sort of like everything's sort of ubiquitous at this point. The LA Times breaks a story. 5 minutes later, it's in Chicago, New York. Nobody knows who broke it and nobody credits anymore. And then just the breakdown of journalism in a general sense. You're at the New York Post. We're here in Baltimore where the sun's in this direction and the banner's there. It's never going to go back in the box. But for the people that did it that walk away, like your guy did to go back to St. Bonaventure, there's a point for me where I'm like, I don't know that I'd have the patience to do that again or think about it the same way now that I've lived. Hopefully three quarters, maybe only half of a whole life, but it was pretty intense breaking news. So intense that it's more fun to be running St. Bonaventure for people that have even succeeded at the level that you and I would have aspired to.
Right. I mean, look, I mean, he's one of my best friends. I'm godfather to his son. And so I bore witness to a lot of what the ESPN job was, and obviously he was well compensated for it. Obviously he became famous for it. The Woj bomb became a thing, as famous a thing as Twitter ever invented. And it wasn't that he was unhappy. He just, he just wondered if this wasn't hijacking the rest of his life, and even before the St. Bonaventure opportunity came about, he started talking to me anyway, certainly very privately, about about there being an exit strategy for him, that he was just ready to just walk away. And then the Bonaventure thing happened to open up at the same exact time, and I can assure you that he works every bit as hard at his new job at 1/100th the cost as he did at the dull one. It's just that while his old one was a job and it was a job he liked very much and he was very invested in, this is this is working for a school that he met his wife there. He met a lot of great friends and people there. Gave him a real start, a real foundation in the business. He feels very strongly and passionately about St. Bonaventure University. People want to be cynical about the about why he would have done this, and I can assure you, there isn't a scintilla of cynicism about it. I mean, this is a guy who loves St. Bonaventure, an opportunity for a job that he couldn't have imagined in his dreams, when we were going to school there, opened up. And he happens to be the most qualified guy in the world to do it because he knows all the people involved, all the agents that he's dealt with for all these years are now peddling college players. All the coaches that he dealt with, the college coaches he dealt with and knows very, very well, are now people that, that he's competing against for players and for NIL dollars. And look, I mean, he's still, for the time being anyway, he's still a very famous brand. And that's really helped a school that would have been otherwise challenged to find marketing opportunities to raise the kind of NIL you need to be competitive in a league like the A10. And that's what he's done already. I mean, it's pretty, they got to deal with the WWE. They give out a belt every year, every win, and it's spread like wildfire. He's been able to, to enter into, corporate sponsorships and agreements that we wouldn't have had a prayer of getting as a school, frankly, if we didn't have Woj on our side. And Mark Schmidt is the basketball coach, and he said it. If he was in the transfer portal, Duke and Carolina and Kansas would be bidding against themselves to try and bring him in. But he happens to love this particular place in this particular unknown part of Earth, and it's been a blessing for him, but it's a blessing for the school also. And it's so far so good. He hasn't gotten one player yet. We won 22 games this year. So I mean, and we're in the NIT. So maybe the Woj magic touch has a little bit behind
Maybe not quite what Dion did in Boulder, but close.
it.
Mike Vaccaro is here from the New York Post. I haven't even gotten the Yankees with you or any of that kind of stuff. I mean, we've got a transition here with ownership, and I mean, you mentioned NIL, and I had Pat Scarry from Towson on for everybody. Towson made a hell of a run in the CAA and then lost in the semifinal last week in Washington, so they're not a part of it. But mid-major, and Pat Scarry talked mid-major and money and how much College of Charleston has versus how much Towson would have. I'm befuddled by all of that, but I'm trying to figure out baseball, my friend, because we have a new owner here who's money bags, $2 billion, buys out the Masson thing for whatever that is with the Lerner family in Washington, and now going to get $600 million of our collective money to fix up Camden Yards and this and that. I'm trying to figure out baseball and revenue models and streaming and where this thing's going. And look, you and I have been at this since we were pups reading, the Lords of the Realm and dealing with baseball strikes in 1994, right? All these years later, the revenue's gone up, 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 up. Player Association still has a grip, but not the kind of Marvin Miller grip that they once had. I worry about baseball not having big money, not having a wide touch in places like Baltimore where they play in the city and no one wants to come to the city and all. I am really interested in how they're going to resurrect this thing here and really compete with the Yankees and the Red Sox and the big boys and the Dodgers and whoever it is, that it doesn't become like NIL and have and have nots. It's been have nots from the beginning, but I'm trying to figure out the new world of baseball and their revenue model to keep people like Gunnar Henderson here instead of going there.
Right. And look, I mean, I'm not just saying this because I'm on the Baltimore Positive station, but I grew up at a time when the Orioles were the model for all of baseball. The Mets had success against them in 1969, obviously.
Don't bring
You
that up.
know, the Yankees had a little success in the 70s, but for the entirety of my life until I was a junior in high school, the Orioles were the model franchise. The Oriole way was a real thing. And Earl Weaver and all those great players, and I think what really I still remember this. I was 15 years old. Was it the last day of the 82 season when they It scared the crap out of the Brewers and won the first three games of a four game series to end the season, and they actually lost game 162, and so the Brewers won the division. And the ovation that followed the game in Memorial Stadium was both exhilarating and puzzling to me, because I was growing up on Long Island in New York, so I knew that if the Mets or the Yankees had lost game 162 at Yankee Stadium or Shea Stadium, they wouldn't have been cheering. They would have been near riotous conditions. All the venom aimed at the home team, and yet here was this magical place where the home team had lost, and yet the fans were smart enough and invested enough to thank them for the effort and give them a standing ovation. And I know that was, I believe that was Earl Weaver's last game, his first tenure with the team. And of course, I mean, I guess they were rewarded for that loyalty the very next year. So to me, baseball, specifically the American League, and even more specifically the American League East, in which the Yankees reside, is so much more interesting when the Orioles are interesting, when the Orioles are good. The last 2 years have been terrific to watch because, 2 years ago especially, because it was kind of just this amazing innocent climb, and they just pounded the Yankees every time they saw them. And look, I mean, it's not easy for Yankees fans to see that. I don't think many of them are as detached and can appreciate that as much as I can, but I thought that was wonderful. Last year, I know that that things went a little bit sideways sometimes for the O's, but to me, it's just Yankees Orioles to me is what I think about when I think of an American League baseball game, even more than Yankees Red Sox. You'll think I'm nuts because that's obviously the ancient rivalry. I wrote a book about the Yankees and the Red Sox rivalry, and it's wonderful on its own in its own context. But to me, the Yankees and the Orioles is what I grew up with in the American League, and it's just a better product when you have. And look, I mean, then you can talk about the franchises that are like the Orioles, the mid-market, the mid-majors, if you will. And so I'm always happy when the Guardians are playing well, or when the Royals are playing well. It's just a better product, and I get it. What we're going with this, Nestor, because it is worrisome, because it's great that Juan Soto got what he got, because the free market exists in baseball for a reason, and that's what they fought for 60 years, trying to get players paid what they're worth. But you also noticed there was a restricted list of people who could seriously bid for him, and they were all teams that were in either major markets or had unlimited pockets, and wind up going to the guy with the deepest pockets in the biggest city. And that's
Well,
great for
we're
Mets
trying to
fans.
figure out, do we have a sugar daddy like they had in San Diego, like they had in
Right.
Detroit, or is he going to, as he said out at Beth DeFillo the night that I heard him speak? Well, baseball, we tend to spend what we make. Well, if you're going to spend what you're going to make in Baltimore, I hope you're making better ideas. Yeah, like
Yeah.
literally, because I don't know where this dream revenue is going to come from in a city without Fortune 500, in a city that now has a football team siphoning money out of it, just on in a general sense that didn't exist in 92, 93, 94. When this and the Washington franchise. So there's a lot of things here that work against the 1995 Cal Ripken version of what the Orioles were, and all of your sugar plum dreams of Jim Palmer and Earl Weaver in 1983. It was 42 years ago. You know what I mean? Like, I'm trying to say, how can this be mature, and how can it be awesome great again and 3 million people? I don't know that it's going to be that.
What's funny is that I can't believe I'm actually saying this, but the Yankees are actually closer to the Orioles universe than the Mets are in this sense. Look, the Mets are owned by a guy who's worth $21 billion, which is unfathomable money. But just think about the fact that if he just chose to devote 1 billion of those $21 billion of resources to the Mets over the next 10 years, he's still going to be able to pay more than anybody else in the universe pays their players. The Yankees don't have that luxury. The Yankees are plenty rich, don't get me wrong. I'm not crying poverty on their behalf. They won't cry poverty on their own behalf. They make plenty of income, and probably more than anybody else. They're all owned by a guy who has to answer to his partners. And look, he always hears about how his father didn't care about money and didn't care about price and yada, 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 yada. But as you said, it's a different model now. You know, when George first put together the best team money could buy in 1977, the entirety of running the baseball operation was a little over $2 million. And even if you factor in inflation, in 2025, that's like $17 million, which is what you're going to pay Aaron Judge until Memorial Day. You know, it's different now when you're talking about devoting $750 million and plus to one player over the course of 15 years. You know, there are partners. You know, back in the day, George would laugh about how his partners never got dividends and never saw, you know, were always asked for cash calls and so forth. And he would joke about how it's the cost of, you know, it's the cost of getting a good season ticket for the Yankees. And Hal can't have those that life parted exchange with his partners because this is serious money. And you know, the Steinbrenners own the team, but they own 60% of the team. So in order for it to, you know, in order to make these deals happen, they are beholden to other people outside the family, which, you know, is nobody in New York wants to hear that. You know, they just want the Yankees to spend, spend, spend. And I think that on a, you know, it's a relative term. I think that's what all baseball fans want of their respective owners is an understanding that they're not in it. They shouldn't be in it just as a money-making prospect. You know, they in theory make plenty of money in their other ventures in life. Baseball should be a civic duty, and if that means, you know, taking a loss every now and again for that to happen, then that's the way it's got to be. But unfortunately, that's easy for guys like you and me to say because we're not the ones who are rolling out the money. But that's ideally what you want, you know. And you know, we have the same situation in New York with the Giants. Look, I mean, half of the Giants is owned by John Mara, and the Mara family's entire business is the Giants. They don't have a steel corporation that allowed them to buy the Giants. They bought the Giants because they were willing to put up $500 for it in 1925. It's one of the great stories of sports, but it's also one of the harsh realities of today's sports is that, you know, the fiscal part of the game is so much different than it was even 10, 15, 20, and certainly 50 years ago.
Well, that's what forced Art Modell out and Steve Bisciotti in, and we go from old owners to new owners. I'm just trying to figure out what kind of owner
Yeah.
this owner's going to be in a sport without a salary cap, and in a sport where the Dodgers and the Mets and other teams are going to spend, and in a sport where when your best players, Gunnar Henderson, Jordan Westberg, are represented by Boris, who's going to take them to market. What are they going to find when they get to market? Mike Vaccaro writes about sports better than anybody. This thing started on Feinstein and ended on Yankees, just the way I dreamed it up. You working on any books or anything? I mean, what's going on in your life
You know
right now,
what? I
Mike?
just pressed the button on a book, interestingly enough, about this the Steinbrenner years with the Yankees. So 1973 on. Literally just pushed the button on it. Hopefully it'll be out by late summer. It's called The Bosses of the Bronx, and you know it's not a biography as much as it is a kind of a narrative of what it's been like since January 3rd, 1973, when George bought the team, and subsequently with when Hal took over for him 15 years ago. And yeah, I mean, I enjoyed the heck out of writing it. So, and like you, as I wrote a lot of it, I was thinking about our boy Feinstein and, you know, how we might address this particular story. So, yeah, so it's a, I'm looking forward to seeing people read that because it was a fun one.
I can see in your smile that you're channeling Feinstein right now and up to no good. Mike Vaccaro is here. We have honored the great John Feinstein. I would remind anyone if you want to find Unlimited John, there's about 22 hours of it up on YouTube. You can click on our YouTube channel. We did present that last week, and we'll continue to talk about him. I have his book One on One in front of me. These thick tomb books that he have. It'd be like when I wrote Purple Rain 2 down at the beach. People came by and they said, "That book. That's a really thick book. Ain't got no pictures. I ain't read no books in a long time." And then we got this form of government. So good luck to you on your George Steinbrenner thing. I would say this. I read a Bronx Zoo, the Bronx Zoo, you know, back in the late 70s. This feels like a nice little catch up on that, right?
Kind of is. I mean, I like to think that some of the spirit of that book and the Greg Nettles book, Balls, and a few other books, you know, I do get into a lot of the stories. You know, my editor said, don't overthink it. Play the hits, and so you're going to get a lot of the George Steinbrenner hits, and so you know, a little bit more. I think it's a pretty fun read.
Well, Reggie and Dave Winfield and some of the folks are still here to maybe even provide you with some stories as
Absolutely.
well. Mike Vaccaro does it better than anybody at the New York Post. You can find him out on the web. You can find him out on social media telling stories of New York sports, St. Bonaventure, and the Yankees. I feel like I got all the boxes checked on this one. It's March Madness week. It's opening day week. Luke and I will be in Toronto, Canada next week for opening day, where the Orioles will be getting booed off the field, and I will be drinking expensive, cheap Canadian beer, but I like that sort of thing anyway. I am Nestor. We are WNST, AM 1570, Towson, Baltimore. We never stop storytelling and talking Baltimore positive. Stay with us.